Inspired by my own journey with mental health, I founded Girls Talk, our own safe space where we share, listen, and support each other. So get cozy and join me, Adjoa Burr, for some much-needed Girls Talk.
Hi, Girls Talk fam. Today's episode includes mention of suicide. If this topic is in any way distressing to you, be gentle with yourself. This may not be the Girls Talk episode for you. Today, we have Julia Samuel on the podcast. Not only is Julia a tremendous friend of the Girls Talk community, but she has 30 plus years experience working as a grief therapist for the NHS and now in private practice. We'll talk to Julia about her new Sunday Times best-selling book, Every Family Has a Story, How We Inherit Love and Loss, and answer some of your questions. Let's get started. So Julia is top-notch, numero uno, Girls Talk member, really. You've been with us for a very long time and you generously give us your time whenever you have it. So first of all, thank you for that.
I'm a big fan of yours and I'm a big fan of the Girls Talk community. And what you're doing is really important. And so it is nothing but a privilege to have my tiny little part in it. I'm thrilled.
And the last time we spoke was in COVID for the Girls Talk Ambassadorship Program. And you came on as one of our lovely speakers and you spoke to our wonderful girls about grief. I know who you are, but it would be lovely if you introduce yourself to our lovely listeners.
It's so interesting, labels, isn't it?
Yeah, so interesting.
Because inside, I am as messy and chaotic and doing my best and know stuff and don't know stuff and love lots of people, hate people, have a good day, have a bad day, as everybody else.
I love that. Love people, hate people.
Yeah. And I sometimes hate the people I love. And I never love the people I hate.
Yeah.
But if you're looking at sort of my work life, I've been a therapist for like 33 years. I worked in the NHS for 25 years. I'm founder patron and worked, launched and established a charity I've worked with for like 28, 29 years called Child Bereavement UK that supports families when a child dies or when a child is bereaved. And then I have written three books, Grief Works, This Too Shall Pass, and Every Family Has a Story, which is sort of multi-generation. That's my most recent one. And I have an app called the Grief Works app. So if any of you are grieving and you want actually the equivalent of therapy, but it's in an app, you could find that. We maybe put a link in the show notes.
Definitely. You've spoken about this before, but it would be lovely to kind of go back and understand what inspired you to do the work you do. And is it the same things that kind of drive and reason why you still have that fire in the belly and the work that you continuously do for other people? Or has it changed over the years?
I really like the word inspired. And I don't know that I was inspired, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was looking for. Being in the group, I knew I felt something I'd never felt before. And I was very curious to kind of find out more about that. And I guess what led me there was, I mean, there's lots of external things and there's lots of internal things. So the external things were that I was brought up in a family where both of my parents had had very significant losses. My mum was an orphan by the time she was 25. Her mother, her father, her sister and her brother had all died. Wow. And all tragically. And my father and his brother had died. All again, suddenly and unexpectedly. So there was a lot of unvoiced grief. There were these black and white photographs around the house of people who were never, ever talked about. And if my mum ever talked about her brother who was killed in the war, he was killed in Arnhem, she would cry as if it happened yesterday. So there were lots of silent messages that I picked up. And we as a family talked about everything that didn't matter and nothing that mattered.
Yeah.
I adore my parents. They're both dead and my siblings, but there was a lot that wasn't dealt with. I was the youngest of five children with two sets of twins. I have a twin brother
two sets of twins.
Yeah. My mum had 5 children in 4 years.
Wow.
So some of that dynamic meant, I think, that I've kind of looked for connection.
Yeah.
Being a twin, if you're a twin in utero, if you look at twins in utero, they suck each other's thumb. They press their noses against each other. Their toes are kind of crossed. Their knees are entwined. So I think I've always have a heightened sense of wanting connection. So I think the combination of my bereaved parents wanting connection and then things that happened to me, things that I did put me in the way of organizations and recognizing about loss and stuff. So I started training and I volunteered with a wonderful organization called Westminster Bereavement Service. And I really do remember the first, again, it was like going to AA Al-Anon. When I went, I walked into this council flat and I walked into this room in a December morning where a woman blaring electric heaters and a television and a radio on, and her daughter had been killed in a lorry accident about 4 months before. And I didn't know what I was doing and I'm not sure I helped her. I saw her every week for about 6 months, but I knew I'd find what I wanted to do. So I was always scared and I felt ignorant. So the thing I have had now for over 30 years, like talking to you, is there is nothing that I find more kind of enriching and in some ways empowering than listening to somebody else and working out what's going on and working out what's going on in me in relation to them. Like with you, you know, we've hardly met each other, and yet I feel like we have a bond,
mm-hmm.
and that we have a kind of knowing and a trust and a warmth. And that does something for me. It feeds me, and that will always feed me. Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, go ahead, Julia.
So one of the things I say to people is that when you look at yourself, maybe there's things about you that you don't fully understand. And maybe if you look at the generation before you and the generation before that, what are the untold stories? What are the secrets? What are the stories of shame and difficulty that haven't been processed that you may be carrying?
Yeah, I turned 31 this year, but 30 last year, obviously, and that felt like I was really going into next chapter of my life, and some of the things that I'd be kind of delving into in my 20s felt like not in the past, but they didn't feel like as prominent. And I feel like I've entered this new chapter and I'm really looking at that sort of stuff.
You're an adult now.
Exactly. And I think it's partly to do with deeper conversations with my parents. And I wanted to go into that a little bit more, but seeing them as humans and not just my parents. So our conversations feel a lot more grounded in just being humans and not putting them on a pedestal. So there's a different sort of honesty. And I think it's also because we as a family have been grieving a lot in the last couple of years. So we're having to unpick that silence, really, you know. Will, my cousin, died by suicide probably, you know, I think it was, I'm so bad with time and I don't know why.
2 years ago.
Yeah, 2 years ago, exactly. So we're having to unpick that and the silences around that.
So difficult.
And then there's my uncle who died by suicide quite a few years ago. And the conversations that I'm having with my father because of Will's death, and it brings up his own trauma and the silences. I remember when my uncle went missing, I thought he'd been like kidnapped. Do you know what I mean? Because we didn't speak about it. So I went to school and I said, my uncle's been kidnapped. Do you know what I mean? Because no one said, you know, he's died by suicide.
The silence around trauma is so pervasive, isn't it? And you're left making up stories, and the stories that you make up are much worse than the truth, however bad the truth is. But also it costs you something.
Mm-hmm.
It eats something in you, doesn't it? It takes something from you, that silence, because in some way someone hasn't been open with you and then you're not open in yourself. So something gets a little bit fractured.
Yeah.
To do with trust, to do with connection, to do with safety.
And I think that silence has definitely, you know, we talk about ways of dealing with things, and I think that's something that has been passed along through us all. I think something as a family that we are trying to be, You know, even a friend texted me today and she was like, you and your family are so strong. We're dealing with another kind of family situation. And it's like, maybe sometimes that's not the greatest thing. Maybe we should all have a little bit of a breakdown more often. But I think as a family, we still have that within us where we're like, hold it together, hold it together. And maybe that's because sometimes that takes the form of hope. Maybe I don't want to let it all flow out because I'm still kind of holding on to this idea that it is just going to be fine. But sometimes it is very important to kind of like let it all out. And I don't think that's something that we're very good at doing as a family. Do you know what I mean? We've done it in different periods. I know that when I was going through my own personal difficulties, that I think the family, they had to kind of let it out to some degree in family therapy or individually. Sometimes it wasn't just in the family. Sometimes it was Al-Anon or certain friends. And I think also one of the big things I think about, going back to your question, is also identity. This is something that I feel like I'm having to really dive into. And maybe it's a conversation I need to have with my dad, you know, him moving from Ghana to London. What was it like for him to be the only black man in a very white kind of setting? And I think I'm having to look at that kind of going into a predominantly white space at school, being brought up around mostly white people, and how that has, you know, I think it's not a big T, going back to your trauma analysis, but I do think it is a small T for 100%. And it makes me very untrusting. It keeps me from sharing, because I think it's a double heartbreak. There's the heartbreak of just society and the climate we live in and the fact that we're still dealing with this ignorance and naivety. But when you open yourself up to a friend, it's the second heartbreak. It's like, oh, you don't see me. You don't see me for who I am. I know that's something my sister deals with. I know it's something that I'm sure my father deals with. So I think that would definitely fall into the category of something that I'm going through right now.
I really am moved by what you say in so many ways. And there's a lot of kind of insight in that, recognizing that when painful, difficult things happen, whether it's a suicide or some family crisis, we do need both. We do need to have ways that keep us holding together and give us hope and not kind of fall apart. And also we need to allow ourselves to feel the pain of it, to express it, to be sad, to shout, to grieve. And that it's the movement between the two that supports you to adjust. And that when you get locked in one behavior over the other, that's when you get kind of maladaptive processing. And I think British society, because of the First and Second World Wars, was very much be strong, you know, keep calm and carry on. And what you don't talk about isn't going to hurt you, very much like my parents. And they didn't really have an option.
Yeah, exactly.
They didn't have choices. They didn't have knowledge. It's not like they knew they could do something better. This was the best they could do. But I also think we need to hold on to the capacity to be resilient as well and allow yourself to do both. And I think what's so interesting about when you're talking about your racial identity and the kind of weathering of being mixed race in white spaces and then you being brought up mainly with white people with a white mum, I think when you say the lack of trust, what I get from that is a kind of very deep existential lack of safety.
Yeah, no, 100%.
The small T trauma you talked about felt to me like a small threat. It's not like someone's going to spit in your face and call you a terrible name. But obviously people talk about it, the microaggressions. But even I think the fear of a microaggression,
that is the fear,
can create an internal defense mechanism that then means it's harder for you to kind of fully jump in. Like when you meet someone, you probably don't just fully open your heart and go, you know, although you are very loving and energetic. But it's almost the unconsciousness of it being kind of what Christopher Bolas calls the unknown known, you know, the unthought thought. Something, what does he say?
Google.
I'm just looking at it. Unthought known.
The unthought known. That's very, very good.
Like you know it, but you can't fully let yourself think it.
Yeah, it is. It's exactly that. I think also with age, I don't know if intolerance is the right word, but I'm definitely more confident. And I think I present myself with a way that I want to a certain extent. Do you know what I mean? Because I do think going back to that trust, it's not, you know, I'm not like an open book always and not to everyone.
But nor should anyone be that.
Yeah.
No one should be an open book to everybody.
Yeah.
You should be an open book with the few people you really trust.
Exactly. And I present myself in a way that I think I'm not always viewed as, and that can be very weathering to my own sense of self.
Tiring.
Yeah, very tiring.
Exhausting.
I was at a wedding the other day and I stayed up late, and there was a point in the evening where I was like, is it time for me to go? Is someone going to say something? I don't know what they're going to say. They probably won't say anything, but it was just that little bit of fear that was like, maybe it's time for me to leave.
And that is just a spike in your system.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't have that.
Yeah.
I might in Ghana.
Yeah.
When I'm a white face in a black space, but not here.
Well, you know, I've gone back into therapy.
Oh, good for you.
I know. It's good. It's exhausting, but it is good. It is good.
But the other thing I'd add is that in some ways the defences that one has to develop in order to walk into those rooms can be received as quite a hardened you, like, you know, she's punchy.
That's another one. Do you know what I mean? Because I can come across like that.
Because your mum is actually quite like that, to be
very
fair.
Very like that. I have a bad habit of when things feel chaotic or I don't feel safe in a space. My life is quite busy and I have a lovely big family who mean the most to me, and they're the people that I feel the most safest with. So when things feel chaotic, instead of kind of dealing with them head on, I kind of withdraw, which I think gives the impression to people. And I'm not hot and cold, but if I love you, I love you 100%. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But if I feel like you are maybe burdening me or making me feel a certain way, I withdraw, and I think it becomes very apparent to people, especially the ones that, you know, I love. Like you said, I hate the people that I love sometimes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There was an incident the other day when my sister was like, I could feel it. And I think that person could also feel it because they were also overcompensating. They could feel that you were withdrawing. So they were trying like extra hard. But the thing is like, I was talking to my sister and I was like, sometimes I feel like it's quite unfair because I'm real and honest. And so sometimes I have to bear the brunt of being the more like, I don't know, grumpier, more hard, you know, resting bitch face sister. Do you know what I mean? Which I think is what my mum gets as well. Exactly. I'm not performative at all, you know? So there's that. Going back to the generational trauma, I think there have been wins, you know, there was something that really stuck out. Grief starts at the point of diagnosis, and we've had a family situation that really kind of gave me some great solace just reading that. And
oh, I'm pleased.
Something that's come out of, you know, a situation that we're dealing with as a family is that there is that silence that was there. So when my mum's father was diagnosed with cancer, she was the only person that her mum and dad told. Her other siblings, her three other siblings, were not told about what was going on.
Oh my God, how to create a dysfunctional family. Like,
exactly.
Oh my.
So when he died, you know, that's why we all joke about her being like the kind of like mafiosa leader of the family. But, you know, that was thrown onto her. He died. They didn't even know what was happening. So now with what's going on now, it's like, I spoke to my auntie and she was like, all I want, you know, this is not going to be like an easy journey, but I just don't want any secrets, you know? So that's amazing.
Honesty really helps.
Yeah. Through those like generational kind of situations, there can be a moment of like resolution. And I'm seeing that in different aspects.
So they changed the family story.
Yeah.
So your mum having experienced that, your sisters changed the story. We're not going to be a family that holds secrets. And, you know, secrets is such an interesting thing in itself because you can have secrets that are intended to protect. They're intended to protect the children, or they're intended to protect the esteem of the family, or they're intended to protect someone who can't cope. And I think there are some secrets that are valid for good reasons, but most secrets have a cost, an emotional cost. And certainly when you have bad or difficult things happen in a family, telling some and not others fragments a family, because one person carries all of the emotional burden and then the others feel furious that they've been disenfranchised. So they don't feel protected. They feel livid. They've been exiled while one was included. And so I think when people are thinking about secrets and protection, they should really think carefully about what it's like not to be told. It's heavy.
It really is. How do we make sure the pain we experience today doesn't affect the generations after us? Obviously, people are going to mess up whether we like it or not, but I suppose we answered that really by just talking about our own like personal experience. But how would you kind of...
I think anyone listening, if they think about how they respond to difficulty and their internal awareness when they respond to difficulty, I think that will give them a lot of information. Like, I hate bad news.
Oh.
I mean, I really
hate it. Yeah.
And so when I get bad news, my first response, and there is nothing I can do about this, 33 years of therapy is like decades of therapy, I turn away.
Really?
I turn away. And I'll just shut down and won't look. I mean, if I have to, I do. But because I know I do that, I know that in a couple of days, I then have to turn towards whatever it is. I have to let myself feel it. I have to name it. I have to find ways of expressing it. I have to find someone to support me that I can talk to. And then I have to find a way of kind of going through it rather than avoiding it and cutting it off. And I think if anyone listening, they will all know, like yours, you tend to withdraw.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different version of shutting down.
Yeah.
It's a similar thing. What is useful to look at for yourself is if you have a very fixed response and you don't go back and address the difficulty, you may be carrying a pattern that you got from your parents or your grandparents. And so a kind of mark of healthy patterns, if you like, is adaptation, that you have the capacity to adapt internally and behave externally given the difficulties that you face. If you're very, very rigid and that this is the highway, this is the only way, and I'm going to shut down and battle against it, however you do that, it could be working as an addict, being a workaholic, or it could be addiction, it could be all sorts of things, then that's probably worth exploring.
Even after all the work, obviously you answered this, but does it take just a few days for you to kind of process, turn your back on it, to then realise that you kind of have to walk towards it?
The bigger it is, the harder it is to walk towards.
Yeah.
But I do tend to. But I mean, it takes me some really big things, like a big thing happened about 2 years ago. I did turn towards it and I did talk to Michael about it, my husband, and I talked to my children, but it actually took me a long time to properly internally process it. And I think that's what's also useful, is that the external event, someone's died or we've moved house or we've lost our job, happens very fast. Our capacity to adapt and adjust and to allow the pain of it to come through us and then grow through it and even thrive after it takes a long time.
Yeah.
So we need to give ourselves both the support of other people, the compassion towards ourselves, and not be impatient, because processing is a long process. It always takes longer than we choose. And I think in the sort of tech world, when we want the kind of the fast track app to get through something, we expect our being to kind of operate fast. And we don't. We really don't.
No. It's like those waves, you know.
Yeah.
It just hits you I remember speaking to you about it. You know, this is obviously in regards to grief, but sometimes obviously it's a birthday or an anniversary and sometimes it just hits you out of the blue.
Yeah.
And I think you're completely right. It's empathy towards yourself and towards other people. It was only the other day that I was thinking about Will's sisters and I was like, you know, to others, maybe it feels like it's been quite a long time, but it's like, there's something you said about it lives in the body and interrupts every aspect of a person's life. And it's something that I keep in mind even before I read this. It's like they're going through it like every day, every second of every day. And, you know, actually, because obviously he was my family member, he isn't my brother. Do you know what I mean? So I move through life in a different way. But sometimes it's not only the bad news, but it's also knowing as a family member or as a friend, it's not just the days where it's happened. It's also the long journey that awaits them and being there for them as well. I even said to someone the other day, because I'm like finding people quite chaotic at the moment. And I was like, you know, there's just so much that needs to be done. Life is, you know, in the grand scheme of things for like a lot of people. And I'm sure a lot of people, you know, like life is fine. And I don't mean that we aren't allowed our small T's and our isms and all sorts of things, but there are some people that are dealing with like massive, massive changes in their life. And I can't deal with your small thing right now. I've got to show up for someone else actually.
But I think what I was thinking when you were talking about your cousins and for people listening is that we do have, as human beings, this incredible capacity to find a way of living despite all terrible, devastating things happening to
us. It's incredible.
But also, we don't get over stuff.
No.
So that we can, you know, you can have a sibling that's died by suicide and it is agony and the intensity of it is equal to the love. And if it's by suicide, it is in some ways indigestible. It's never okay. And you can never tell yourself a story that makes sense of it. You can never find a way of it being okay. And you can learn to accommodate it. But I think in the culture, we have this idea that you get over these things, like you move on and then you're fine. And they will be changed by it and they will live and love again, probably take them longer than they choose. And they won't get over it.
No.
It will influence them and shape them. And at different times in different phases of their life, they'll be hit by it. You know, like my mum with her brother. They might see the back of someone walking down the street 30 years later and it'll remind them of Will. And they'll just suddenly get this kind of wave of loss. And it won't mean they haven't grieved. It won't mean they haven't done the business. But we are sentient beings. We can't put our feelings in Marie Kondo drawers and just pull them out when we choose.
Fold them up.
Fold them up and colour code them. Like today's my pink pants day and my pink feelings day. And no, they run us. Emotions are transmitters of information to give us information whether we're safe or under threat. And the things that we do to block the emotions are the thing that does us harm over time and sometimes through generations.
I'll never forget what you said to our girls about when dealing with someone who's like going through grief and trying to support them. It's like by bringing up that person, you're not going to remind them about what's happened because that's in their body, their heart, their mind.
All the time.
You're not just going to remind them. And it's something that I keep so close to me when walking into situations like this. It's like, do not fear that you're going to make them feel bad.
Worse.
They already feel bad.
Yes.
They already feel shit.
But also remembering how, you know, the love for the person that's died never dies.
Yeah.
And you saying their name and acknowledging that you miss them or you'd love to talk about them is the gift that you can give them.
I think that's a lovely end to our conversation. And I have a few questions from our wonderful community because they wanted to get involved in this particular podcast because of your treasure trove of information. So I wanted to give them the chance to ask you a few questions. So this question is from a Girls Talk community member called McKenna.
Hi, my name is McKenna and I'm calling from New York City. My question for Julia is, as someone who's dealt with grief, loss, and death from a young age, I find that now that I'm an adult, I'm starting the grieving process all over again. So one, is this normal? And two, why is my acceptance phase of grieving so harder now than it was when I was a teenager or a child?
I think what's really interesting is that we do grieve previous losses at different phases of our life because we relate to them from a different perspective. So as a teenager, you have a particular view and a particular missing. And then when you're kind of 28 or 30, it's like, oh my God, my mum is still dead. And I need to talk to her now. I need to talk to her about my boyfriend or my job. So I think we have to rework the loss in different phases of our life. And I think reworking it, like, oh, you can be furious, like not accepting, like, here we go again. I am fed up of being someone who's grieving. I want to get on with my life. I don't want to be this person. I want to be the happy me. And actually, I think what often happens is that if we support ourselves and allow ourselves to grieve through this next developmental phase or whenever it's emerged, then you do process it faster. I think when she talks about acceptance phase, you know, the Kubler-Ross phases and stages of grief, as like steps, you go from denial to bargaining to anger to acceptance. And actually, they're not steps, they are emotional waves that we move in and out of. And I think paradoxically, if you accept this wave that you're in and allow it to come through you, you will paradoxically heal.
Thank you, Julia. And last question. This question is from our Girls Talk program manager and therapist, Chiavelli. During COVID, it feels like we all experienced a form of secondary loss of self, identity, and security. How do we grieve for the parts of us we lost while making space for the person we would become?
That's another really great question.
Our girls are amazing.
They are amazing.
So proud of them.
So I would call that a living loss. So it's experienced with all the emotions of grief, but often isn't legitimized, is often diminished or dismissed. So I'm really glad she's legitimizing it for herself. And I think maybe one way of doing that is, I was thinking about internal family systems. There's the Dick Schwartz thing of, we have lots of different parts. We have lots of different identities, but also we have different parts, like our good part or our bad part or our scared part. And what I would suggest that she does is get a big, big piece of paper and draw shapes or colours to represent all of her different parts. And those parts will have subparts and give them voices. So the parts that feel sad or felt disenfranchised or, you know, she lost years of time and years of connection with people and years of confidence or whatever it was that her experience of loss was, represent that, but also put in it that she's feisty and funny and has fun. And so put everything that represents herself and give them a narrative, give them voices. What I do with clients is I get the adult them to talk to that part. So the part would say, I'm feeling really sad and pissed off. And so that you kind of give them a voice. And so you can do it as a dialogue with yourself. Does that make sense?
I love that. Yeah, makes perfect sense. I think I'll do it myself.
Got mine up there.
Really?
Yeah. So I've got a lot. I've got a lot of parts.
So at Girls Talk, we create safe spaces online and in real life. And the podcast is no different. So it's a safe space. Okay, tell us the last time you laughed until you cried.
I was with my daughter, Natasha, and she was taking the piss out of me because I was so useless. What was I useless? I can't actually remember, but she's got a very contagious laugh. She was taking the piss out of me that I was really useless at something. And I was trying to say that I wasn't useless. And then I realized I really, really was as useless as she said she was. And we both just cried laughing. It was great. And I fucking hate her as well.
Yeah. For pointing out
your
flaw.
My flaw.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was so righteous and I was sure it was right. And then I suddenly realized, it's like, oh, okay.
And she's a therapist as well, isn't she?
No, she isn't. I have got two other daughters that are, but she isn't.
Oh, okay. God. Thank you, Julia.
Oh, thank you, Edward.
Thank you so much. I get so much from these conversations, and to kind of echo what you said, I feel exactly the same. It's mad. It's a knowing, isn't it? It's light sees light, dark sees dark. It's a beautiful thing to feel connected to someone that you don't necessarily know very well. But with you, I feel like we cut through the bullshit and we get straight to it. And that's definitely something that works better with me. I love that.
I think what I think is that the definition of love is being known yeah. and seen as you see yourself. So it's a kind of loving. I do feel that we have a kind of loving.
We do. And I've told you lots of different, I've been on your podcast, I've told you more things than I tell, you know, people I've known for years. And that's because you create that space. So I hope that I created that space for you. I care for you and love you very much. And thank you for being on the podcast. And my lovely listeners, I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. And as always, mad, mad, mad amounts of love. Thank you to the wonderful Julia Samuel for joining me on today's podcast. You can buy Every Family Has a Story at all major book retailers. You can also listen to Julia on her podcast, Therapy Works, wherever you listen to podcasts. We may have stopped talking, but that doesn't mean you have to. Talk to us on our Instagram at Girls Talk, or send us your poetry, essays, stories, artwork, or anything else you want to share at girlstalk.com. This week's podcast was produced by Girls Talk and Wicked Child Studio. Original music composed by Mikey Long. Mad, mad, mad love to Jo Malone London for their generous support of the podcast. And as always, we are always here and we're always listening. I'm Adjoa Boa, and this was the Girls Talk podcast.